So I'm going to officially welcome everyone, and we're going to start the session in just a few minutes once you go through some basic housekeeping rules. So again, good morning or good afternoon, depending on your time zone. I wanted to welcome everyone to today's Internet Seminar, which is going to cover understanding the Fiscal Year 11 Job Training Grant Application Guidelines, which has been sponsored by the U.S. EPA's Office of Brownfields and Land Revitalization. My name is Jean Ballant, and I work here at EPA in the Technology, Innovation, and Field Services Division, and I will be serving as today's moderator. We are going to go through some basic ground rules before we get started so that a couple of last-minute participants can hop on the line, and then we'll officially kick things off with our presentation today. Everyone should have the materials for today's session either downloaded or printed or open on a computer screen in front of them right now. If you don't have those materials, just a reminder that when you registered, you were sent to the seminar homepage. You were given a URL by email as well as a page on a confirmation message when you signed up. And on that seminar homepage, you were able to look at a detailed description of today's session, take a look at the instructor and their contact information as well as mine, download the materials in a few formats, and then take a look at additional links that have been pulled together for today's event. You can join the slides and look at them online through your web browser by clicking the Go to Seminar button, or again, follow the links to download the PowerPoint presentation that show up at the bottom of that seminar homepage. That seminar homepage will continue to exist after today's session, so if you want to follow up with other comments or questions, feel free to go back there or refer to the seminar homepage at any time. Just a reminder to everybody who's joining us from phone lines, we do ask you to keep yourselves on mute. That'll help cut back on background noise. That's exactly what I'm going to do in a minute. I know I'm in a little bit of a noisy section myself. If you don't have a mute button on your phone, you can hit *6 to mute your line. At the appropriate times for Q&A with the instructor, I will remind you how to take yourself off of mute by hitting *6, but we'll let you know at that time. So until then, we do ask everyone hit *6 right now to mute your line and help cut back on the background noise. Also, don't put the phone call on hold. Sometimes there can be advertisements or commercials that will be running in the background, and that will be disruptive to everyone. So thank you in advance for your cooperation with that. So again, keep the lines on mute by hitting *6. Hopefully, everybody has got the slides open in front of them by now, and I want everyone to move past slide number one and move on to slide number two. This is a reminder that the session is sort of a manual session, so you will each be required to manually move through the materials based on the instructor's cues. If you are looking at the slides online, you can use the orange icons along the top of your slides. Okay. The single arrow pointing to the right will move you forward one slide. The single arrow pointing to the left will move you backwards one slide. You can also use the numbered links that appear on the left side to navigate through the materials. Otherwise, if you have them printed, just flip through the pages at those cues as we go through the materials. Another thing to point out, those of you that are looking at the slides online or streaming audio, there's another orange icon along the top with a question mark button. As long as your pop-up blocker has been disabled, you'll be able to use that question mark icon to submit comments or questions at any time to the instructors. You don't have to wait the Q&A period for those. You can certainly, as soon as the question or comment occurs, type it up, and at the appropriate time, I will read it out loud on your behalf to the instructor. We'll also take a break, though, for those on the phone line so you can directly verbally interact with the instructor as well. Again, you want to keep that pop-up blocker disabled to make sure the question mark button will work and you can open a new form. You can also use that very same form to report any technical problems you may be having if you have issues with the audio or the materials through your web browser. Again, our instructor will be indicating as he moves through the material. If you have any questions or comments, go ahead and type those up through the question mark icon or hold them until we go to the verbal question session with the instructor. When we're all said and done today, we're going to provide one additional slide at the very end of the presentation materials, and that slide will have two links that are important. The first link will be a link to additional resources where you'll be able to look at a number of other websites and resources that the instructors have put together relevant to today's topic. You'll also be able to download the materials for today's presentation there. The second link will be a feedback form link, and we do ask everybody to spend a minute or two to fill out that very short form and let us know what you thought of today's session. I do look at each and every one of those, and if you'd like to continue to see free online training like this delivered through Cluin, you want to be sure to fill out that feedback form. If you're participating in this training for PBHs or CEUs or some sort of credit program, you may also want to be sure to fill out that feedback form and check the confirmation message box on the form to have an email confirmation message sent to you for your records that might help verify your participation today. One final reminder is that this entire session is being recorded and it will be archived on the Cluin website. So if you think this is a valuable resource, you can refer either your colleagues or other interested parties back to the Cluin website, again at cluin.org/training, and follow the links from that training page to the archive session. You can even find us in iTunes, as we have a Clueing Archive Seminar podcast available. So with that, I think those are the end of the reminders. I'm going to ask everybody to move over to slide number three, and I'm going to officially turn things over to today's instructor, who is Joseph Brush. He's the Environmental Justice and Job Training Coordinator here at the EPA's Office for Brownfields and Land Revitalization. Joe, are you ready?
Yes.
Great, thanks.
Hi, everyone. Thanks so much for joining our call today. This is the second of two Clueing seminars. We had the first one on Monday, and we had a really great turnout, a lot of new faces, and we're really excited about the expansion of this grant program for fiscal year 2011. I'll get into that later in the presentation. The objective really today is to provide an overview of the Environmental Workforce Development and Job Training Grant Program for prospective applicants like yourself on the line. And also, I want to mention that this week we did issue our Federal Register notice soliciting comments from the public on the drafted application guidelines. And today's call, we're going to go over the criteria, which will be found in the application guidelines, but this criteria may change slightly. So while the information we'll go over today will be largely the same as what will be in the actual request for applications or application guidelines, which is anticipated to be issued on October, there might be some minor changes, so make sure that you look at the guidelines. With that said, again, my contact information is on slide number two. My name's Joe Bruss. Besides serving as the lead for the Job Training Grant Program, I also work on environmental justice, and my email information and phone number can be found on slide two. The agenda for today, we're on slide three. First, I'd like to provide kind of a history, a context of the program, why we do this program. Congress appropriates funds for us to deliver this grant program, in addition to other grant programs that the Brownfields office also has, such as assessment, cleanup, and revolving loan fund grants, which are separate programs from the Job Training Grant Program. Secondly, we'll talk about the competition, the application process, go over the threshold eligibility criteria, the ranking evaluation criteria, attachments, and application tips. And I'm going to try to move pretty quickly so we can allow time for questions and discussion at the end. Slide four. Slide four, that's a picture of one of our successful job training programs. That's the Milwaukee Community Service Corps. They've received funds several times, and they have an excellent program there. Slide number five, history of the program. The first seeds of the Brownfields job training and of the Brownfields program itself really emerged in the 1990s, and it reflected EPA's growing concern for environmental equity, later known as environmental justice issues. Among the lessons learned from the very first EPA Brownfields pilot grants was the realization that the community surrounding brownfields, and for those that don't know what brownfields are, think your old abandoned industrial sites, the Rust Belt, abandoned gas stations, mine-scarred land, meth labs, really old, potentially not necessarily contaminated properties that are lying idle and abandoned, which are usually found in low-income and minority neighborhoods, not only in urban areas, but also in rural areas. Brownfields were really benefiting from the job opportunities created by their assessment and cleanup. So EPA realized that these brownfields-related jobs were being filled by environmental professionals from other cities, due to a lack of environmental training among local workforces. Next slide.
About 10 years too late for us.
While EPA had no resources allocated for job training during the initial years of the Brownfields program, the agency had already collaborated with the Hazardous Materials Training and Research Institute, HMTRI, to offer environmental education and training program assistance to community colleges located near Superfund and other hazardous waste sites. While the goal of adding a job training component to the Brownfields program, EPA tapped the expertise of a number of other federal entities with established job training programs, such as the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, who we also continue to work with to this day very closely. Please keep your lines muted. Thanks. Slide number 7. Here's just a little timeline of the program. In 1995, EPA announced the first brownfield pilots, which we now call grants. In 1996, EPA signed a memorandum of understanding with the Department of Labor focusing on job training and employment opportunities related to the Brownfields program for local youth and adults. In 1998, NIEHS established a Brownfields Minority Worker Training Program in collaboration with selected EPA Brownfield Assessment and Cleanup pilots. In 1998, EPA awarded its first 11 Brownfields job training pilots. And I don't want to go through all the details of this since you can look at it later. But on the next slide, you'll see in January 2002, the President signed the Small Business Liability Relief and Brownfields Revitalization Act into law, known as the Brownfields Law. This legislation amended CERCLA to specifically authorize federal financial assistance for brownfields revitalization, including grants for assessment, cleanup, and job training. CERCLA had language specifically authorizing job training grants under EPA's Brownfields program, authorizing EPA to provide grants for training to facilitate site assessment, remediation of brownfields, or site preparation. To date, more than 5,800 participants have completed training, and more than 3,800 have obtained employment in the environmental field with an average starting hourly wage of $14.65. Next slide. So where are we today? Again, like I mentioned, we're really excited about the expansion of the program. And this year, EPA's Brownfields program led an effort to collaborate more closely on workforce development and job training with other programs within EPA's Office of Solid Waste and Emergency Response. So the other offices besides the Brownfields program in OZ were include the Office of Resource Conservation and Recovery, ORCR, they deal with RCRA issues, the Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology, the Office of Underground Storage Tanks, Federal Facilities, the Center for Program Analysis, who really is working on renewable energies at formerly contaminated sites, the Innovations, Communication and Partnership Office, that looks at more innovative types of projects, and also the Office of Emergency Management. Next slide. The goal was really to develop a job training cooperative agreement opportunity that includes expanded training and other environmental media outside the traditional scope of just brownfields. In the past, over the years, the job training grant program has really seen a lot of proposals from organizations that wanted to deliver training that wasn't really related to brownfields. For example, in California, there's a community that has a lot of air pollution issues, and they really wanted to train individuals in retrofitting of engines. But unfortunately, you know, this wasn't a type of training program that we could support because we had to operate within the stovepipe of our statutory authority to really focus on brownfields and hazardous waste. So as a result of these discussions, the Environmental Workforce Development and Job Training Grant Program, formerly known as the Brownfields Job Training Grant Program, will now allow applicants to deliver additional hazardous and solid waste training. This program is also going to support Osworth's community engagement initiative. Next slide. Osworth's Environmental Workforce Development and Job Training Grants will train residents of communities impacted by a variety of waste facilities, blighted properties, and contaminated sites for environmental jobs that cleanup contractors may otherwise fill from outside the community. Through this expanded program, graduates will develop wider skill sets that will improve their ability to secure full-time sustainable employment in various aspects of hazardous and solid waste management and within the larger environmental cleanup and remediation field. We really believe that by having graduates have a diverse set of skills, a portfolio of certifications, that is only going to help them obtain sustainable employment. We know that brownfields assessment and cleanup work oftentimes is short-term and contractual in nature, and this program has never really been about just putting individuals in jobs for 3 months and then they're unemployed again. We've always advocated for long-term sustainable, not just jobs, but really careers in the environmental field. And while I want to note that while we're expanding the training this year to really other Osworth programs, federal facilities, Superfund, underground storage tanks, emergency management, we haven't yet had the ability to bring the program agency-wide. We really hope that in the next fiscal year, for fiscal year 12, that we're going to have a collaboration with the Office of Water and the Office of Air and the Pesticides Program to support other types of environmental training, not just in brownfields or within Osworth, but in wastewater treatment facility operator training or engine retrofitting, for example, like I mentioned earlier. So, you know, we're really excited about the leap that we made this year for expanding the program, but we want to take it even further in following years.
Sorry, this is Jean. There were two questions that came in, and they're just basic definitions on acronyms. So some of the participants would like to know what CERCLA stands for and then what OSWERF stands for.
OSWER is, again, the Office of Solid Waste and Emergency Response. That's our larger office that the Brownfields Program, the Superfund Program, Underground Storage Tank, et cetera, fall under. CERCLA, you can really think of it kind of as the Superfund Law, the Comprehensive Environmental Response, Compensation, and Liability Act. Well, CERCLA, or as many would probably know, Superfund, I'm sure someone out there is testing my description of this, but CERCLA, or the Superfund Law, as it was really originated, was amended later on to include the Small Business Liability Relief and Brownfields Revitalization Act, and that happened in the 90s when a lot of stakeholders and the public said, well, these aren't Superfund sites, all these abandoned buildings or, you know, sites that aren't being developed by developers because a lot of them are scared of the liability associated with undertaking the site. So the Brownfields Law was really passed to address all these other different types of sites that really didn't fall under Superfund. So, and again, brownfields also include abandoned gas stations, mine-scarred land, and also meth labs. So we're on page 11 now. I think I covered this. We'll now go to slide 12. Program requirements. Proposed training programs must target unemployed and underemployed individuals. Applicants will be evaluated on the extent to which they have partnered with local contractors and other stakeholders working on EPA-funded projects for brownfields, federal facilities, Superfund, underground storage tanks, landfills, oil spill sites, or EPA-funded state or tribal corrective actions or closures at solid or hazardous waste facilities or landfills. In the past, we had a requirement that in order to be eligible, you must have some kind of brownfield site in your community. Well, since we opened up the program this year to collaborate with other OSRA programs, it's not going to be an eligibility criteria, but you will be evaluated based on what kind of partnership you have with the EPA-funded waste site or facility in your community. Again, this grant program was really created to benefit local residents from assessment, cleanup, redevelopment activities. So we really want to make that linkage with whatever site is in the community. Applicants should establish procedures to ensure that graduates will be employed in environmental work that involves preventing, assessing, managing, or cleaning up contaminated sites with a focus on the graduates' respective communities. EPA Brownfields Program and OSRA are committed to integrating principles of environmental justice by helping communities revitalize contaminated properties, mitigate potential health risk, and restore economic vitality. And environmental justice, you know, again, the individuals that enter this program are predominantly low-income minority individuals. Our program does not have a restriction on age, as other federal training programs oftentimes have. We support training of all different age groups, male and female, but individuals must be unemployed or underemployed. This isn't a program that trains individuals who are already working and making livable wages. Next slide. The core curriculum. Because we've expanded the program, the strings attached to that are as follows. All environmental workforce development and job training program curriculum must include the 40-hour OSHA HAZWOPER training. We've required that training in the past. It's very basic and pretty applicable to any kind of waste site. We'll also require lead renovation, repair, and painting, the RRP certification, the new lead certification. And as a result of the other funds that are coming to support this grant program for FY11, we're also going to require that each applicant propose to deliver innovative and alternative treatment technologies. And we'll have an FAQ. I'm sure a lot of you are asking, what does this mean? You can think of it as like solar installation training, phyto remediation, stormwater management, more innovative types of training. We'll also require leaking underground storage tank prevention awareness training and training related to some type of solid waste management, assessment, or cleanup. That could include construction and demolition debris recycling, landfill remediation and capping, recycling center operator training, etc. With that said, you know, I don't want individuals to say, God, we got to deliver all this required training. Again, we really want to encourage applicants to propose curriculums that are diverse. We want graduates of the program to walk away with a diverse portfolio of skills. You might say, well, you know, the HAZWOPER training and the lead renovation, repair, and painting certification training are really core types of training. In the past, we've, you know, a typical curriculum would include HAZWOPER, OSHA, lead abatement, asbestos abatement, mold remediation, confined space entry, and then it would be that core training would be supplemented with additional training such as construction skills or other innovative types of training, maybe green building design or landscaping or, you know, the list goes on and on, emergency management. But, you know, you'll see for the last three different types of training, the innovative and alternative treatment technology, the leaking underground storage tank prevention training, and solid waste management training. Some applicants may say, well, you know, EPA is telling us that they really want us to design our curriculums based off hiring needs in our community, but we don't really have any need for individuals to be trained in leaking underground storage tank prevention. So this is why we're underlining awareness training. All three of these last different types of training can be awareness training. So it could be a 1 or 2 hour class on C&D recycling, construction and demolition debris recycling, for example, or it could be, you know, an hour on underground storage tanks.
Oh, this
please
is just a reminder.
Your line.
Exactly. If we hear that again, Joe, I'll globally mute everyone, okay?
Okay,
so again, if
thanks.
If you don't have a mute button, simply hit *6 to mute your line. Thank you.
Okay, so again, we have required training this year, and that required training is found on page 13. We'll also have some frequently asked questions, which are going to be posted when the guidelines or the request for applications is issued in mid-October. So you can see additional information related to this required training. Next slide, page 14. Supplemental training. So while you'll have your core training program, the required training, this is where you can really have the flexibility to deliver other types of environmental training based, again, on the hiring needs in your community. We do not want applicants to propose training that is not going to result in work for graduates of that program. And Myra Blakely, my boss, her anthem is, the biggest disservice that we can provide graduates or residents who are entering these training programs, who are looking for work, is not having work at the end when they graduate. So while you might think leadership in energy and environmental design training sounds really great and excellent, if it doesn't result in work for an individual, then please do not include it. That doesn't mean we want you to deliver new and innovative types of training, because we absolutely support that. And oftentimes we see that by having innovative or really a diverse curriculum, that it's going to result in long-term employment. But on the other hand, you want the certifications and the training curriculum to result in employment. On the side, you'll see kind of a list of other types of supplemental training. Also in the application guidelines, which again, you can find by going to www.epa.gov/brownfields. There's a link to the draft, underlined drafted guidelines. And under the eligibility or use of funds section, you'll see certain types of training or examples of training that we're supporting. So for example, you may want to supplement your core required training with training in weatherization, energy auditing, phytoremediation, native plant revegetation. If you're a tribe, you know, I've heard there's a lot of issues with white goods recycling, freon extraction, the list goes on and on. We also support training in construction skills, commercial driver's license, hazmat, you know, again, the list goes on. Based on the geographic hiring needs of your community, curriculums are going to differ dramatically. Next slide. So what are some of the job examples graduates of the program go on to? Again, the most core basic job is environmental technician. Another example could be someone working at a recycling center, emergency response technician, a GIS expert, treatment storage and disposal facility tech, health and safety, underground storage tank removal specialist, a forklift operator, construction, plumber, electrician. Next slide. Historically, EPA has really set a high standard for successful job training grant applicants. In past years, an average of 1 out of every 4 applications was funded per solicitation. From year to year, 90% of previously unfunded applicants were funded after reapplying. So if you weren't successful last year, please, please resubmit. Statistics have shown that, you know, usually those individuals that keep reapplying, you're going to get funding eventually. Before 2009, before green jobs turned into such a popular buzz term, and before the economic recession, you know, we probably got about 40 proposals nationwide each year, and out of those, we funded 12 or 13. Under the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, that was the largest number of proposals we had ever seen. We got over 90 proposals. Last year, under the regular fiscal year competition, we received a little over 70 proposals. For FY11, the total estimated funding available for environmental workforce development and job training grants is approximately $4 million. For the first time, EPA is planning on raising the grant award amount to $300,000. In the past, it was $200,000, and we anticipate awarding 13 cooperative agreements or grants with two-year project periods. Next slide. To begin the application process, again, in early October, go to www.epa.gov/OSWER and click on the grants and funding link to find a copy of the FY11 guidelines available for download. You can also access the application guidelines by visiting www.grants.gov. Applicants may choose to submit application packages either in hard copy or by submitting their proposal electronically through grants.gov. As a reminder, you may want to sign up for the Brownfields listserv so you can receive an automatic notification of when the RFA is issued. You can do that by visiting EPA's Brownfields website, again, www.epa.gov/brownfields, and you'll see a link there to sign up for the listserv, so you'll get an automatic notification. Next slide. Hard copy submission. Applicants must submit two complete packages, including all of the documents identified in the forthcoming proposal guidelines. Complete packages must be postmarked by the closing date and time for receipt of application packages. One complete package must be sent through regular mail, express mail, or courier to each of the following recipients. Please send one copy of your complete proposal to Environmental Management Support to Keith Arnold, and also send a copy of your proposal with all attachments to your regional job training coordinator. And your regional job training coordinator, if you don't know who that is yet, I encourage you to pick up the phone when this call is done and to give them a call to notify them that you're anticipating on applying, and to ask any kind of questions you might have. Their contact information will be found at the end of the presentation today, and they'll also be listed in the application guidelines. Again, you can also submit your proposal electronically through grants.gov. If you're going to do it electronically, I suggest that you get into the system early and register, because I've heard there are glitches sometimes. Next page. This is just a picture of another one of our successful grantees, the Oregon Tradeswomen. It's an all-female training program, and they've really done some excellent work. Next slide. The threshold criteria. The threshold criteria are really the eligibility criteria, and they're pretty straightforward. They include applicant eligibility, the required training that I just went over, and the funding amount. Applicants that received a Brownfields job training grant from EPA in fiscal year 2010 are not eligible to apply in fiscal year 2011. If you did receive funding for a job training grant under the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, you are eligible to apply for FY11. EPA will notify applicants who do not meet the threshold criteria within 15 calendars of the failed determination. Proposals that meet the threshold criteria will then be evaluated based on the ranking criteria, which I'm going to go over. Applications that fail any one of the threshold criteria will not be considered further. Next slide. Applicants must demonstrate they are eligible. Eligible applicants include nonprofit organizations with 501c3 status, municipalities, quasi-governmental organizations, governmental entities, states, tribes, workforce investment boards, colleges and universities. This year, we're really trying to do some targeted outreach to tribes, historically black colleges and universities, tribal colleges, and other minority academic institutions. Some may ask, well, why? Because they're really in a prime spot to deliver training in the communities that they serve, those being low-income minority communities. We have funded several HBCUs and minority academic institutions in the past, but we're really hoping to see more proposals for FY11. If you are a for-profit organization, you are not eligible to apply. Also, in Alaska, under the Brownfield Statute, unfortunately, Alaskan tribes are not eligible to apply unless you're the Metlakatla tribe. If you are a nonprofit organization or an Alaskan tribal corporation, you would be eligible to apply. That's the Alaska glitch there. Next slide. Again, all environmental workforce development and job training curriculums must include the HAZWOPR, the 40 hours, the lead renovation, repair, and painting training, RRP, underground storage tank leak prevention awareness, underlying awareness training, innovative and alternative treatment technology related awareness training, and solid waste management or cleanup related awareness training. Now, I mentioned, some of you may feel that underground storage tank leak prevention training isn't really going to benefit any of the graduates of your program. That's why you're going to deliver awareness training. However, if you are in a community that has a lot of underground storage tanks, this is an opportunity for you to develop training related to this that is more robust. Some of these types of training, depending on your geographical area, might be very useful. If you're located near an electronics recycling plant and you know that there's going to be jobs there and you want to train individuals in that, that would fall under solid waste management. If you're working on a landfill closure, solid waste management or cleanup. We want to remain flexible. Next slide. Proposals that request more than $300,000 or with project periods in excess of 2 years will be returned to the applicant for revision. Again, we do anticipate an increase in the grant awards this year, but nothing has been set in stone. You will see the final details when the final request for applications is issued in mid-October. Next slide. General application requirements. Application packages must substantially conform to the outline and content detailed in Section 4C. Pages in excess of the page limitations for the transmittal letter, your cover letter, is 2 pages. The narrative proposal, which includes all your responses to the threshold criteria and ranking or evaluation criteria, is 18 pages. And then you'll have a 20-page limit for your attachments. We'll cover those attachments later, and in your attachment that will also include support letters. All application materials must be submitted in English, including support letters. I apologize, Puerto Rico, but please submit your proposal in English. Do not include binders, spiral binding, or color printing. Photos and graphics will not be considered. The transmittal letter and narrative proposal must be typed on letter-size paper with a font size no smaller than 12 point. Next slide. Again, please, please, please pay attention to the page limitations. Any pages that exceed the page limitations will not be reviewed. Reviewers won't even see it, so make sure that you follow that. Ranking criteria. Applicants must directly and explicitly address all criteria as part of their narrative proposal. Each application will be rated under a point system with a total of 100 points possible. Each application will be evaluated according to 6 evaluation criteria. And the 6 criteria are comprised of subfactors that vary in scoring value. Next slide. What are our ranking criteria? The first one, community need, that's 20 points. Next one is our training program description, anticipated outcomes and outputs, worth 27 points. Programmatic capability, institutional capacity, community and employer partnerships, and budget and resources. Next slide. Community need. I usually tell people this is the easiest subfactor as long as you answer it and provide a description. It's just a matter of telling us about your community and the need there. Describe your target community. What are its demographics? What are the impacts of these demographics, and how do they relate to current challenges and environmental justice concerns? Describe your target community, including the population, location, history, and environment. Provide demographics, include the unemployment rate, the poverty rate, foreclosure information, the minority population, sensitive populations such as women or children, or immigrants, recent economic disruption data. Provide us information on health disparities. If there's a Superfund site, tell us about, you know, exposure data that you might know of. Or if it's a brownfield site, tell us that, you know, individuals have elevated rates of cancer there. Discuss how these indicators of need relate to current challenges and environmental justice concerns. For those that don't know what environmental justice is, it's really traditionally looked at how low-income or minority neighborhoods have been disproportionately impacted by environmental contamination, the proliferation of contaminated sites, whether there's been a history or lack thereof of meaningful involvement of local residents in decision-making, whether there's been enforcement issues at waste polluting facilities. The list goes on. Provide the source of your information. To what extent will you recruit or train specific populations indicative of need, such as ex-offenders, veterans, etc.? Next slide. Describe the negative impacts these hazardous waste sites have on the target community, such as the economic, environmental, public health, and social issues. Provide examples of sites if you want to. Economic impacts include loss of tax revenue and presenting an obstacle to investment. Environmental impacts include potential contamination of air, water, and soil. Social, public health impacts include adverse health effects on community residents and blight. Be descriptive. Help the reader visualize these impacts. Make sure your response is compelling. Make the reader cry, we say. Emphasize the specific benefits your target community will receive if you are awarded this grant. Be careful to ensure a connection between your community statistics and the focus area of your project. I know that sometimes, or I'm not sure, excuse me, if unemployment data is available right now for certain communities. So, but try to get us that information. Census data sometimes can be rather large and generic. We really want to hear about what the statistics and need are in the specific neighborhood that you're planning on targeting. Next slide. This is very important. Have you conducted any employer surveying or local labor market assessments? Describe how you know of the local demand for skilled environmental workers. List specific activities you have done, including research conducted. Describe the procedures you use to conduct a labor market assessment. Discuss the results of your assessment. Is there a need for skilled environmental professionals with certifications? And are those certifications incorporated into your proposed curriculum? Oftentimes, we receive proposals with really generic labor market assessment information. An applicant will say, well, we've read in so-and-so journal or report that there's a need for individuals trained in hazardous waste handling, and it's expected to increase dramatically in the next few years. Well, you know, you've answered the criterion, but, you know, we're going to look more favorably if you said, we contacted 25 contractors, environmental consulting firms, engineering firms in our community, and 10 of those have expressed an interest to hire, and they've told us that they're looking for individuals with the following certifications, et cetera. So employer surveying is really great. Next slide. Describe the structure of your proposed training program. Present a clear and concise description of the proposed job training program, including the number of training cycles, the number of hours per cycle, a description of core training and required training versus supplemental and awareness training, the number and type of certifications to be earned, whether courses will result in a state or federally recognized certification versus a certificate, the names of courses, and the schedule of classes. Perhaps you are going to target underemployed individuals in your community. Well, oftentimes, if that's the case and you're targeting individuals who are at minimum wage, who want to make better wages, maybe you want to hold your classes in the evening versus during the day. I mean, these are all things that the reviewers are going to look at. How detailed is your training program? This description should match the training program outline attached to the proposal. So here's your first attachment, a training program outline. Next slide. What are your anticipated enrollment and placement numbers? Again, this is also very important. How many participants do you expect to enroll in the proposed curriculum? How many students do you anticipate will complete the proposed training program? What is your targeted placement rate of those students that complete the program into environmental remediation jobs? Do you have a detailed plan for evaluating your progress toward achieving expected short and long-term outcomes and outputs? To what extent is your proposed timeline for achieving deliverables clearly identified, detailed, and realistic? Please note, the minimum acceptable placement rate for FY11 is 70%. In the past, we had it at 65%, and that's really low. Most successful proposals that get funded are proposing to place individuals at a much higher placement rate. We want you to be realistic at the same time, and we want you to be ambitious, but we don't want to see just the bare minimum. A lot of applicants ask, well, what's the standard number of individuals who should be completing a training cycle? And we don't have a set standard, and that's really going to depend on whether or not, number one, you're an established training program. If you're in a rural versus an urban community, we're going to look to see at how intense your curriculum is, whether or not individuals in your program are just going to get 3 certifications versus another program that's going to provide 10 or 12 different certifications. So that's going to really inform the number of individuals that are going to enter your program. Typically, if you're in a rural community, we've said that we'd like to see at least 20 individuals per cycle. If you have a 2-year project period, more than likely you're probably going to have 3 cycles at least. Well, I would say not at least, but you'll have about 3 cycles. If you're in an urban community, there's a much larger pool of individuals to draw from. We want to see those numbers go up. Next slide. How will you recruit and screen students for your job training program? What strategies, tools will you use to market your environmental workforce development and job training program? Tell us what methods you'll use to recruit, such as newspaper, radio, posters, word of mouth. From which areas in your community will you recruit? Tell us what criteria you'll use to screen applicants, such as high school diploma, drug testing, different levels of reading, etc. I would say most programs do require that you're at least 18 years old, but there's no set recruitment criteria. that we require programs to establish. How will you address retention and attrition issues? Will students be responsible for any fees? Hopefully the answer is no. Such as licensing, certification, medical examination, etc. Are training facilities accessible? Meaning, are they close to public transportation or near parking facilities? Again, hopefully the answer is yes. Next slide. To what extent will your organization provide job search support and resources for participants of your program? Tell us how your organization will assist with initial job placement, retention, and continuous employment for participants. How and for how long will your organization track graduates? We do require as a term and condition for these grants that you track graduates for at least 1 year. We want to ensure, again, that individuals aren't just placed in a job for 1 month and then they're unemployed, and that they continue to receive services and assistance to help them have sustainable employment. Describe any local hiring incentives, such as first source or local hiring ordinances, tax incentives, wage subsidies, etc., that will increase the likelihood of employment for graduates. Some applicants in the past just choose not to answer that part, and they say, oh, well, we don't have any first source hiring ordinances in our community. Well, I'll tell you, there's lots of different federal tax and hiring incentives that apply to everyone. So make sure you do the research for this one. Next slide. If you've ever received an EPA Brownfields grant, please respond to the following. This is the programmatic capability criterion, and this criterion will be provided or reviewed by the regional office who may have experience in managing grants with your organization. Identify up to 5 EPA Brownfields grants you currently have or have received in the past. If you've worked on a Superfund job training initiative project, please also mention that here. Demonstrate how you successfully managed the grant and successfully performed all phases of work under the previous or existing grants by providing information on the balance of grant funds not drawn down on, funds remaining. Sometimes we have really, really excellent grantees with great programs, but they don't draw down on their funds. They really don't have the financial management system, or if they've done a poor job. That information will be taken into consideration here. Compliance with the work plan, schedule, terms and conditions, and timely quarterly and financial status reporting, specifically quarterly reports, ACRES. ACRES is our Assessment, Cleanup, Redevelopment Exchange System. That's our online Brownfields data collection system. If you've received a grant from us in the past, and not just a job training grant, but also if you had an assessment or cleanup grant, we want to know what your history of reporting was. Success in implementing the goals of your EPA grant funds, etc. Next page. If you've ever received an EPA Brownfields grant, describe any adverse audit findings, provide information regarding your accomplishments, including the number of individuals you committed in your proposal to train and place versus what was provided in your negotiated work plan, the actual number trained and placed. If the original anticipated training and placement goals were not met, what steps were taken to improve the program? And is the data accurately reflected in ACRES at the time of your submission, of your proposal? Perhaps you received a job training grant from the EPA in the past and you had some difficulties. We want you to be honest and to tell us if you had issues or difficulties, or maybe it took a while for your program to get off the ground. Tell us about that, but tell us how you are correcting the problem. Tell us what steps you've taken. Perhaps you were a past applicant or grantee, and you told us in your proposal that you were going to train and place 120 individuals through your program. But then when your work plan was negotiated, you lowered it. You know, this is the information that we're going to look at. I don't say that to scare you, but again, the competition is getting a little bit tougher, and we want to fund grantees that will be successful. Congress gives us this appropriation. We know that a lot of programs are doing really great work. They're putting people to work. But if you don't report that information to us, why does Congress want to continue to fund this program? We need reporting data. Next slide. If you've ever received an EPA Brownfields grant, please also describe the management system you'll have in place to direct the activities under the grant, including a description of the project manager and staff expertise, experience, and qualifications, et cetera, et cetera. In evaluating responses, EPA might consider relevant information from EPA files or from other federal grantors to verify or supplement information provided by the applicant. For those applicants that never received an EPA Brownfields grant but have received other federal or non-federal assistance agreements, please respond to the following. Again, this information is similar to what I just went over. If you've never received a grant, you'll, again, I'm just looking over the information here on the next slide. Again, that information is pretty similar. Doesn't necessarily mean that you're at a disadvantage if you've never received a grant. We want to fund new phases, but we also want to fund applicants that are guaranteed to put people to work. Next slide.
I'll take a new phase.
This is just a reminder. Keep your phone lines on mute. If you don't have a mute button, hit star 6. I can hear background conversations. Again, star 6 to keep your phone on mute. Thank you.
The last thing about programmatic capability, if you've never received any type of federal or non-federal assistance agreement, please indicate this in your proposal and you will receive a neutral score. That neutral score is 10 points. For most applicants, they've received some type of financial assistance. It doesn't necessarily have to be federal. You know, tell us about private grants that you've managed. We're now on the institutional capacity criterion. Tell us about your organization's or partner's experience in delivering an effective environmental job training program. Illustrate your experience working with minority, unemployed, and/or underemployed individuals within your target community. How does your experience relate to your proposed curriculum? Describe your involvement with individuals or organizations listed in your attached reference list. Please mute your lines. Thanks.
So what I'm actually going to do is globally mute them because we've asked a few times.
Okay.
You're going to hear that command, and then when you hear the global mute command, you can hit #6 to keep talking, okay?
Okay.
The leader has muted your line.
So again, #6. Joe.
Can you hear me now?
Yep, I can. Thank you.
Okay. So we're on institutional capacity. Many times we have applicants that apply for funds and maybe they have experience in employment and training or in social services, but they don't know anything about environmental training or they don't even know what a brownfield site is. That's when they're going to have to partner to find that someone who can deliver that training. But we want to make sure that that training provider not only has experience in environmental training, but they also have experience working with the target population. On the other hand, we'll have community colleges who apply. Maybe they have the technical expertise, the environmental expertise, but they don't know anything about life skills training, job development, or anything like that. So it's really a partnership that you're going to have to put in place. Next slide. Provide information regarding your training provider's experience and success in delivering a job training program in the target community. If a provider has been selected, what criteria did you use to select this provider? Please provide a letter of commitment from the provider. If you've not identified an instructor and are considering subcontracting or subgranting to acquire these services, what steps will you use to ensure they're qualified? Perhaps you don't know who's going to do the training. And even if you do, make sure in your proposal that you tell us that you understand that federal grant requirements require you to do a competitive bid to get those services. That is, if you're going to do a contract. You can do a sub-grant to a nonprofit organization. For example, a community college might qualify as that. Next slide. Demonstrate that efforts have been made to collaborate with brownfield stakeholders and or Superfund federal facility leaking underground storage tank or EPA-funded state or tribal regulated corrective action or landfill closure contractors in your target community. Have you made an effort to enhance or foster employment opportunities for job training graduates in your targeted area at these sites? Have local organizations made commitments to assist with your training program to provide on-the-job training or hiring graduates? If so, please provide letters of support from these organizations. Again, this is where we're looking for you to make a connection with the EPA-funded site in your community. Ideally, this is where graduates of your program may be going to work, whether it's a brownfield site, a recycling facility, a Superfund site, etc. Perhaps employers or contractors at these sites don't say or don't give a commitment that they're going to hire. Well, maybe they can assist in developing your curriculum. Maybe they can provide mentoring services. Maybe they can provide internships or on-the-job training. Be creative. Next slide. Discuss your plan for involving the affected community, such as local community groups, workforce investment boards, and academic institutions located in or near the affected community in the job training program. Explain any early steps you took to notify the community about your program, such as conducting a public hearing, visual advertisements, radio announcements. Have any partners committed to providing non-environmental training, such as GED attainment, life skills training, placement assistance, personal protective equipment, etc.? Attach letters of support if so. Hopefully every applicant will, prior to submitting their proposal, solicit feedback from local residents, from community-based organizations, and potential partners for the training program. Something that makes this grant program different from other grant programs is that funds cannot be used to support life skills training. A lot of organizations hate that about EPA's training program, but this is why we've always stressed partnering with local workforce investment boards, one-stop centers, organizations that have the Workforce Investment Act money. This is money that is used to support life skills training, job readiness training, these type of services. The job training grant funds from EPA are really only to provide environmental training. To what extent will your program ensure trainees are job ready and have the pre-employment skills needed to secure full-time work? This is a critical, critical criterion for any proposal. Life skills training is super important, just as much as the environmental training. Next slide. Have local employers and community-based organizations, such as local businesses, environmental contractors, labor unions, site owners, been involved in the development of your proposed job training program? If so, describe any components they've been involved in, such as curriculum development, advisory councils, apprenticeships, mentoring. Please provide letters of support. Have any employers committed to hiring graduates of your program? Hopefully the answer is yes. Next slide. Is your budget clear, detailed, reasonable, and appropriate? Do you include cost estimates for each of your proposed activities? We're now on the budget criterion. Is there a narrative explanation of each task? Make sure that you include both a budget chart and a narrative explaining all the different tasks and numbers you have in that chart. Include a short introduction before the budget chart outlining how you intend to spend the grant. After the budget chart, explain each of your tasks clearly and completely, including the basis for the estimated costs, as well as the projected outputs where possible. Address each cost presented under a task. The cost should appear reasonable based on the details in the description. This is where many applicants lose points! Do not include tasks for activities or costs that are ineligible use of funds under EPA's grant. Direct costs for grant administration are ineligible even if the grantee or subgrantee is required to carry out the activity under the grant agreement. Again, something else that's very unique about our grant program is, unfortunately, the Brownfield statute does not allow administrative costs to be applied to a grant. No overhead costs. Perhaps you're a college or a university. Oftentimes, that's a deal breaker. But, you know, again, this grant funding is really used to support environmental training. A list of prohibited uses of funds can be found in Appendix 1 of the FY11 Environmental Workforce Development and Job Training Grant Guidelines. Do not use acronyms that we're not familiar with. I know what a CBO, and I think most people do, so that's a bad example, but try to be careful with your acronyms. Make sure to allocate some travel funds to attend the National Brownfields Conference and the Job Training All Grantee Meeting. Make sure your budget table adds up. Next slide, you'll see here's a sample budget chart. There's also a line there for administrative costs. You know, we support using grant funds to pay personnel, such as a trainer or a placement coordinator or someone doing recruitment. You know, these are personnel costs that we support. But, you know, we get a little questionable when we see 80% of grant funds going to support personnel and maybe none going towards actual training. That kind of raises a red flag. Maybe you're a nonprofit organization that is just starting to grow and you really need to pay your personnel costs. Well, this isn't the grant opportunity to do that unless they're directly going to be involved in this training program. Supplies, contractual, travel, fringe benefits. These are costs we support, but again, make sure that you look at the eligible use of funds and the guidelines. If you're a community college, don't, you know, propose to use 50% of your funds to buy supplies or equipment through the grant. You know, that's kind of a key indicator to a reviewer that maybe this community college is just trying to use the grant funds to buy equipment to build their institution's program, but not really benefiting graduates or trainees of the program. Next slide. Did you demonstrate how you'll leverage additional funds or in-kind services to carry out your project? Describe additional sources of internal or external funding already in place. Show how EPA grant funds will be complemented by these additional funding sources or in-kind services, such as staff time, life skills training, pre-employment training, GED preparation, child care, academic enhancement, placement assistance, counseling, transportation. If you don't already have additional funding sources in place, indicate when and where you plan to look. Indicate how these additional funds will stimulate economic development after your program has ended. Describe how your organization will manage this grant in light of the administrative cost prohibition. Of course, we're going to look more favorably at a proposal that already has actual committed funds to support the job training program that you're going to deliver. But, you know, we also understand that not every organization, especially in tough times right now where funds are limited, they don't have those outside funds. But they have a whole lot of services and partners and in-kind support that they're going to provide to make the project a success. Make sure that you tell us about those. Please also note, this grant program, we do not require a funding match or a cost share. Next slide. Attachments. Applicants that are not cities, counties, tribes, or states must provide documentation of their nonprofit 501c3 status. This documentation will not count towards the page limitation. Next slide. References. These organizations may be contacted by EPA during the evaluation process. Include a list with contact information, not letters, from the following: two employers who've hired past participants of your job training program, if applicable, two neighborhood and or community-based organizations supporting in the development of your program, and two organizations from the employer community, such as local businesses, environmental contractors, site owners, that have been involved in the development of your program. This can be done on one page. It's just a reference list, but EPA will contact these organizations. We want to make sure that community-based organizations support this project. Next slide. Training program outline. We already covered this. This should include the curriculum topics, course hours, duration of the courses, schedule, etc. Next slide. A milestone schedule. Your milestone schedule should indicate start times and completion dates of significant tasks under your program. We anticipate that the request for applications, again, will be issued in mid-October, with a deadline for submission of applications probably in mid-January of 2011. I think this is the first time in a long time that we've allowed such a large application window. This is really going to benefit and help applicants, we hope, by giving them more time to prepare their proposal and do the many things that require a strong proposal. With that said, we anticipate the announcement of awardees or grants will be made in the spring, probably following the National Brownfields Conference. The Brownfields Conference is the first week in April. So your start date would probably be, I would suggest folks propose a start date that's 3 months after the grant award. So that would be late summer 2011. Next slide, general support letters. Attach general support letters from community-based organizations, past or potential employers, et cetera, et cetera. Support letters will only impact scoring of the subfactors listed in Section 5B5 of the guidelines. Letters must be received with the proposal. Letters received separately after the due date for proposal submission will not be considered. If you get Senator so-and-so or Congresswoman so-and-so from your community to write a letter of support, that's really great, and it might go to, you know, the assistant administrator for the Office of Solid Waste and Emergency Response. But if it comes after the deadline for submission of applications, it's not going to impact the scoring of your proposal. Next slide. General tips. Read the entire guidelines and follow the directions. Following directions is really important. Get mentoring from prior grantees. You can find a list of grantees on that website there. We have fact sheets for every job training grantee that's received funds from the EPA since 1998, I believe. And there's a phone number for each one of those organizations. Write as though the reader knows nothing about your community. Perhaps we know, I used this example the other day on our call, you're an applicant from Detroit. We know that there's huge economic stagnation in Detroit. We know that there's lots of contaminated brownfield sites there. But if you don't tell us about it in your proposal, then it doesn't matter. Address all criteria. If it doesn't apply, say so and explain why. Make sure you respond to every single subfactor. Follow the cover letter outline. Use white space and obey the 18-page limit for the narrative proposal, the 2-page limit for the cover letter, and the 20-page limit for attachments. Type single space, no binders, no color, no photos or graphics. Limit attachments to required and relevant documents and letters. Again, electronic submission information. Next slide. Create a focus plan and show that you know how to implement it. Too much information is not necessarily a good thing. Quality beats quantity. Do not restate the evaluation criteria. Please, please, please follow the format and cite or reference the appropriate criterion and subfactor, but don't restate the entire language that's in the evaluation criteria, the guidelines. Respond clearly and directly to the questions. Although your responses may seem repetitious, you need to respond as many times as asked. Some reviewers may not always cross-reference responses. Address all criteria. If it doesn't apply, say so. Address each element of the criteria separately. Create a game plan for each section in the application. Identify the number of questions presented in each subsection. Highlight keywords that you will want to use in your response. Identify information that you'll need to research or obtain to answer the questions. For pertinent sections, design the actual plan you'll implement if you receive the EPA grant. Be realistic in your planning. Use your plan to answer the questions. A strong understanding of the concepts and well-thought-out plans will come through in your application. I also recommend applicants to really watch the wording that you use. I know that reviewers are going to look more favorably at a proposal that says, we are so-and-so organization and we have partnerships in place with the following community-based organizations. We held a public meeting on this date soliciting feedback from the public. We have already identified and committed $25,000 in support to support our program versus an applicant that says, well, we hope to identify this contractor about employment opportunities, or we will work with so-and-so community-based organization. Already have this partnerships and commitments in place. Next slide. So again, the timeline, I just went over the timeline. FY applications will be accepted electronically through grants.gov. Next slide. Threshold criteria are evaluated by your EPA region as stated. You may be contacted to clarify information in your application. Programmatic capability will be scored by the region. National panels will convene and rank applications. And the Office of Solid Waste and Emergency Response Assistant Administrator makes the final determinations. Maddie Stanislaus, who, by the way, is very supportive of this program. I can't remember the last time we ever had an assistant administrator as supportive of this program. Next slide. Begin thinking about your application package. These are things that you need to start doing now if you already haven't. And again, there's a larger application window this year, so do these things now. Begin thinking about your application. Do your employer survey and get their commitments to participate in your program or to hire. Keep an eye out for the FY11 guidelines in early October. Get individualized letters of support. Please, please, please do not send us template support letters. Hold a public meeting soliciting feedback from the public. Contact partners for assistance in preparing and or reviewing your application, and contact us with any eligibility questions you have. Next slide. Here is a list of all the regional job training coordinators. You can also contact me if you have any questions. And again, I really recommend that if you do anticipate on applying that, you know, just pick up the phone or send them an email and tell them that you are anticipating on applying. One really important word of advice. Now is a key time to contact your regional coordinators and to get advice and assistance from them on developing a job training program, especially if you're a first-time applicant. When the application window is open, when the final formal request for applications is issued, EPA will not be able to provide one-on-one assistance. We do not want to give any kind of perception that we are providing unfair assistance to individual applicants. We want to be fair, and we want to provide everyone the same amount of assistance. But now is the time when you can contact your regional coordinator and ask them more pinpointed questions. Next slide. Here are some additional resources. The job training grant guidelines. Again, there's the draft guidelines, which are out right now with the Federal Register notice. We also will have posted frequently asked questions. Those will be issued when the final RFP is issued in October. This says early October, but I think it'll probably be more likely mid to late October. There's headquarters information online at our website. We also have a really excellent job training report, which you can find on our website. There's a list of past grant recipients, and there's a list of existing and past EPA-funded grantees as well. There's also a really great resource that was developed through a cooperative agreement we have with HMTRI, that's the Hazardous Materials Training Research Institute out of Iowa. It's called the Brownfields Toolbox, and it's an electronic tool, really, that was developed for prospective applicants or even for organizations at large that were interested in developing environmental or brownfields job training programs. I really encourage you to take a look at that. Finally, the last slide. We just have two pictures here. This is another one of our programs. This is at a graduation ceremony in Tucson. It's probably one of the most, touching. I know that's kind of cheesy, but really, when you experience going to a graduation and you see individuals grow through the program and they finally have the opportunity to go out and earn a livable wage, a lot of the individuals that our program works with, again, they're ex-offenders, people with troubled pasts, single mothers, really the most needy individuals from predominantly low-income minority communities that have historically been affected by blight, economic stagnation. You know, this, like, unlike our other grant programs here in the Brownfields program, like the assessment program, the cleanup grant program, the job training grant program works with individuals. This isn't where we work with land. This is really an employment and training program. And with that, I will shut up now and open it up for questions. Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much, Joe. This is Jean Bellin again. Just a reminder, we're going to go to the phone lines in a minute, and I'll provide instructions on how to take yourself off of mute at that point. In the meantime, though, there have been a number of questions that have been submitted online, and I'm going to start with those. If you are listening or viewing the slides online, you can go ahead and continue to submit your comments or questions now by clicking on the orange icon with a question mark on top of the slide. Be sure your pop-up blocker has been disabled, and we'll be able to read those questions or comments off of you as we go through them. And then I will take a break, and we'll switch over to the phone line in just a minute. So I'm going to start with a question that came in from Nevada City in California. And they ask, is it still favorable for your application if you do have brownfield sites in your community?
We're hoping that we're going to get applications from municipalities or areas that have a variety or one of many different types of contaminated sites or facilities. It's not a requirement now, but you know, Congress really appropriated money to support training individuals who would in turn be either assessing or cleaning up or revitalizing communities. So it doesn't have to be a community that has brownfield sites. You know, We also want to encourage proposals from rural areas. And a lot of rural areas, maybe they just have an abandoned gas station. I mean, so we want to remain flexible. But, yeah, if there's a lot of brownfield sites and hopefully a lot of assessment or cleanup work taking place at those sites, that means jobs, and that's what the program's about. So.
Okay, great. The next question is coming in from Texas, and they ask, how do you define underemployed?
We don't. And it's kind of a sticky, you know, theoretical discussion. But really, when we say underemployed, we're talking about individuals who are making minimum wage and just scraping by. This program is not intended to train individuals that have advanced degrees and maybe they've been unemployed for 1 week. This program is really intended to target individuals the hardest to employ. It does include veterans. It includes dislocated workers. Perhaps you're in a community where there was a recent manufacturing plant closure. Well, you know, this is an ideal program to train those individuals, but we don't define underemployed.
Excellent. The next question comes in from Missouri, and they ask, would basic GPS training fall within this arena?
Absolutely. GIS, GPS, yes, we support that type of training.
Okay. Also in the same area, the next question is, if participants are underemployed or unemployed, can funds be used to offset child care, transportation, or the purchase of necessary tools, such as steel-toed boots, trade tools, et cetera?
You can use grant funds for equipment or supplies or personal protective equipment. We encourage you to leverage those costs, but the grant funds cannot be used for life skills training or for child care costs. Additionally, grant funds cannot be used to provide stipends to trainees of a program. We do allow grant funds to be used for transportation stipends, so a bus token for an individual to get to and from class, but not to pay an individual or trainee of the program a stipend while they're taking the training program.
Okay, thanks. The next question comes in from East St. Louis, and they ask, in terms of partnering, can a nonprofit partner with a for-profit when applying?
Absolutely. Yes, the answer is yes, but be careful. We don't want to support sole sourcing. Again, if you are going to serve as the fiduciary or the prime recipient of a grant as a nonprofit organization, but you want to contract to a for-profit to deliver training, make sure that you follow the competitive procurement procedures.
Okay, thanks. Our next question coming in online from Bridgeport, Connecticut. They ask, will EPA allow indirect costs in the budget? We have an indirect cost rate that's been approved by the U.S. Department of Labor.
Indirect costs are not eligible. Again, that's similar to administrative costs. And I know a lot of people have questions about that, but take a look at the draft guidelines that are out right now, and in the appendix, you'll see information on how we define indirect costs or administrative costs.
Excellent. The next question coming in from Fort Lauderdale, Florida, and they ask, can the school that is private provide the training and partner with a nonprofit or municipality to apply directly for the grant?
Absolutely. The city of Fort Lauderdale could apply for the grant as the grantee, the fiduciary, and a private school could deliver the training if they have done a competitive bid to you. So it kind of, the tables reverse.
Okay.
If you are an academic institution and you have the nonprofit arm, though, then you're absolutely eligible to apply. We have funded many community colleges, universities, HBCUs. Yeah.
Great. And the next question I see online asks, this is coming in from Camden, what level of training is required to meet the lead training requirement under the grants, awareness or license?
This is the RRP training, so this is really kind of the awareness training. It's the 10-hour training. We'll have an FAQ on this on the website. In the past, I would say most of our grantees integrated lead abatement certification, and that's a 40-hour certification course, different from the RRP, which is really type of awareness training. So some programs, they'll want to deliver both abatement and the new RRP awareness. This lead RRP training is really widely applicable, and as the EPA, we want to support this.
Excellent. I don't see any more questions online. We're going to switch over and open up the phone lines for participants if you'd like to verbally ask a question. But you may continue to submit comments and questions electronically as we go through those phone line questions. Remember, using the orange icon above your slides to fill out the question mark form. If you are on the phone lines and you'd like to ask Joe a question directly, you'll need to take yourself off of mute. So you want to hit #6 and then verbally speak. So if you have a question, hit #6 and then feel free to speak up on the line.
There's got to be some questions.
You have a pretty good turnout. We had over 100 people that have checked in today.
I know I did a lot of talking, but there's still questions, so go ahead.
Again, it's #6 if you have a question online, or pardon me, on the telephone line. All right. If I don't hear any more questions online, again.
Question coming in from New Jersey. The grant for $300,000, you said over a two-year period. Is that $300,000 for the entire 2 years, or is that $300,000 on a per-year basis?
That's $300,000 for the entire 2 years. Unfortunately, we don't get that much money from Congress to
okay,
do $300,000 per year.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Again, anybody else on the phone line? It's simply hitting #6, and feel free to speak up and ask your questions. All righty, I do have a couple of other questions that came in online. I'm going to go ahead and go to those. If you do have a phone line question at any point, you can go ahead and hit #6 and speak up. But until we hear from another person on the phone lines, again, coming in from Fort Lauderdale, they ask, can the funds be used to pay for rent or utilities?
Yes.
Well, okay.
You know, we don't want to see a huge amount of the grant funds to go towards paying for rent. But, you know, if it's rent for the training space, then absolutely, you know, we'll support that. Utilities, I don't know about that one. I would have to double check. But if it's direct, I think utilities is no. But I think if the costs are directly related to the training program, then yes.
All right, excellent. The next question coming in from New Mexico, they ask, the lead RRP training includes two certifications, lead renovator for an 8-hour certification, and the lead dust sampling tech, which is another 8-hour certification. Do these meet the requirement?
You know, again, different states, from my understanding, and I'm not an industrial hygienist, but there's different requirements that differ per state. My understanding, though, is that the RRP training, it's a national type of training. It's one type of training, and I believe it's 10 hours. But, you know, if you are going to propose to do lead abatement certification in addition to the RRP awareness type training, then you're going to have to add on additional hours. So that might result in, theoretically, 45 hours. So if you have the abatement certification at 40 hours, some of that information that was covered in the abatement training would also apply to the awareness. So then your awareness RRP training, you only have to do 5 hours. But again, I'm not the guru on this. If you have specific questions, you can send them to me. And we'll also try to develop an FAQ on this.
All right, great. There's another question that came in from Menlo Park out in California, and they asked for the 2-year grant. Does all of the training have to be complete in time for placement of those who are trained, or can we train until the end of the grant?
The training must be done within the 2-year period, but placing individuals is an ongoing activity. Ideally, we would like to see training, I think we might have a term and condition that says training should be completed within 3 months before your grant closes. I mean, we want to be flexible about this. And, you know, training is affected by seasons and, you know, different employment, you know, processes or waves. So, you know, send us your specific question on that, you know, later on, and we can try to provide more information.
Okay, the next question comes in from Kentucky, and they ask, are multiple community colleges from a single state community college system eligible for funding as independent entities?
Yes. So a consortium of community colleges could apply, and I think HMTRI is actually on the call today, but they are an example of a community college consortium that we funded through a cooperative agreement. The state could also apply. The state workforce development office or the state environmental program could apply for the grant, or then subgrant or contract to a different, you know, agency or college. So as long as you're listed within the eligible entities that we went over, then it's fine.
Excellent. Again, anybody else on the phone lines have a comment or question? Simply hit #6 and you can go ahead and speak directly with Joe.
I have a question.
Go ahead.
Okay. Will grants be awarded per region? Will it be divided per region?
Under the Brownfield statute, it says that the highest ranked proposals will be funded. In the application guidelines, though, after the evaluation criteria, the selection official will take into consideration other factors such as the fair distribution of funds among different regions, whether you're a federally recognized tribe or maybe you are on the Gulf Coast right after Katrina hit, or, you know, there's different factors, whether or not you're going to primarily serve veterans, if urban versus rural, all those things will be taken into consideration. But generally speaking, it's really the highest ranked proposals.
Great. Are there, again, any other questions? Simply hit #6. You can ask your question directly.
All questions are welcome.
Well, I had a comment that came in online that they mentioned that the presentation was so crystal clear and well done that that's why there are a few questions coming in from the audience.
Yeah, I did a lot of talking. So if you think of other questions, you're welcome to contact us afterwards. Again, I really recommend that you guys look at the activities of the things that you need to get started now. I know it was a lot of information today. It could be really overwhelming. Maybe some of you have no idea about employment and training. Don't be intimidated. We've seen people start from scratch and really create excellent programs. It's the partnerships, et cetera. So, I mean, we really, really want to see new faces, and we wish you good luck.
Okay. I don't see any other comments or questions coming in online, and I don't hear anybody else on the phone line. So, Joe, if you have any other closing statements, feel free to make them now, and then I'll formally close everything out today.
Well, I think that's it. Thanks, everyone.
Great, thank you. I'm going to direct everyone then to the final slide in the presentation material, which is slide number 67. And on that slide, there are two links that I mentioned at the start of today's presentation. The first is the additional resources page, where you'll be able to look at a number of other websites and resources that were discussed throughout today's presentation. You'll also be able to download the slides that we went through today from that additional resources page. So if you wanted to pay attention to some of those tips or the due dates or the schedule and what to do, you can certainly go there and save the presentation for future reference. The other link on slide number 67 is the feedback form link that we will ask you in a minute or two to fill out and let us know what you thought of this presentation. I will read each and every one of those comments, and if you'd like to continue to see sessions delivered like this for free, please be sure to take a minute to fill that form out. If you are looking for confirmation of your participation today for your own personal records, you'll want to be sure as well to hit that feedback form and check the box asking to have the confirmation sent to you. Those of you who are sharing a line and have multiple participants signed in at one spot, after you fill out feedback, there'll be a link on the confirmation message to let another person fill out that form. So you could have multiple individuals from the same computer each fill out feedback and each get their own confirmation record. And with that, I'm going to formally close out today's presentation. If there are any other follow-on questions or comments, you're welcome to contact Joe directly, as he said, or go through the points of contact that were listed in his presentation in your own region. I want to thank everybody for your time and attention, as well as thank the Office of Brownfields and Land Revitalization for sponsoring today's seminar. Just a reminder, this entire session was recorded, and it will be archived and made available in about 1 week on the CLUIN website. So if you go to cluin.org/training, you'll be able to follow the links to the archived internet seminars today and access or download the session for free. So thank you, everyone, for joining us, and I hope that I'll see you again or hear from you again on a future CLUIN internet seminar. Have a great afternoon.